Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have with us from Northern Ireland, by way of beautiful Southern California, Dr. Peter Rollins.
Hey Pete. There. How's it going?
Good. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Now, the last time you and I were together, we were in Malibu just a couple months ago.
Yeah.
You came. I've got this group of guys that I get together with every fall, a bunch of preachers, and you are our special guest speaker. And everyone loved you.
Oh, it was, by the way, I loved it. Malibu, like right by the beach. That was beautiful, man. Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to have a bad time when you are in Malibu right on the beach.
Yeah. That was pretty sweet.
And it's really tough to hear all your stuff about, you know, life's hard, life's crap, but try to find meaning in it when behind you is the Pacific.
I know. I'm worried that now I live on the West Coast, I'm going to start getting happy. And then what am I going to write about? It's going to be actually, that might come up in this interview because there's a particular type of unhappiness in L.A. that I find interesting.
Oh, yeah. We definitely need to talk about that. Now, okay, so I'm on Twitter. I follow you. It makes me feel smart to read your tweets every once in a while. And so I highly recommend everyone follows you. But I'm reading your tweets, and you tweet one of the highlights of 2014, podcast with Pete Holmes, which that's a big deal. That doesn't hurt my feelings. I have a podcast. It doesn't hurt my feelings to see that one. And then I saw you tweet something about a gentleman named Elliot Morgan, who also has a podcast or some video cast or something. And I'm cool with that. I'm cool with you doing other podcasts. I don't feel jealous. But then when you tweet the brilliant and handsome Elliot Moore, that one stung. That stung.
Well, you're looking very handsome today, actually. You brushed your hair for me. And have you got a haircut? That's looking good.
Yeah, just for you. Well, I feel a little better now.
And you know what? I got 600 new followers after that interview.
Are you serious?
So if you can get me six new followers, I'll give you a massive tweet out, okay?
Okay.
And 600.
He has a huge following, obviously. Pete Holmes, that is.
Yeah, I mean, massive. Absolutely massive. And Elliot Morgan as well. Actually, they're both like, got these big followings. And so, yeah, having two people like that who are kind of doing very secular work, you know, they're not appealing to a religious audience at all, gave me an opportunity to see if this stuff actually flies with people who aren't interested in church life necessarily, aren't interested in Christianity as such, whether actually these Christian ideas I'm exploring still have resonance.
And what did you find?
Every time I speak now, there's at least a few people who say, I'm here because I heard you on the Pete Holmes podcast.
Really?
Yeah, so it's really got word out to people, as I say, who often wouldn't darken the doors of church. You're coming to my events now because of that interview.
Yeah, that's great. Well, people don't know, Pete Holmes used to have a late night show on TBS after Conan. And I would assume I'm not the only one, but I got introduced to Pete Holmes because he had Rob Bell on not too long ago.
That's right.
So he does good. I've listened to his podcast a lot, and yours actually is really, really good. You did good on there.
Oh, thank you. Well, I didn't know much about him at all, but I didn't realize how good an interviewer he was. Like, he's a comedian, so he just sits and chats and makes jokes, and it's like 2 hours. After the first hour, I kept trying to land the plane, thinking, okay,
it's
the ending, and then he kept going and going and going, and so it was just a lot of fun, and as I say, primarily because he's coming from a very different angle, and so it allowed me to try and put my own work into a different kind of context.
But he grew up in a conservative religious background, and so he's kind of moved away from that. But it seems like, is that a lot of your audience that has some religious affiliation, they've walked away from it, or just a blank slate that they're got nothing to compare it to?
I mean, my guesstimation here, I mean, it's just a guess, but from what I can see, actually a lot of my audience, a lot of people who really engage seriously in my work are actually people who are very much kind of within Christianity. Now, they all have a problematic relationship with it to some extent, which I think, to be honest, is part of the nature of Christianity, is that you're open to questioning it, rethinking it. But, you know, a lot of the people who I know are people who have being within Christianity, leaders within Christianity, people who are thoughtful about their faith. And I'm really excited about that, but I also now want to see if I can, you know, also appeal to people who haven't had that background.
Do you have any ideas as to why that group really resonates with your work?
Well, you know, it reflects my own position and my own background. So, you know, like attracts like in many ways. I mean, so often when someone comes to me and says, you know, I've enjoyed your work or I've got something out of it, if I ask them about their story resonates a lot with, you know, my own story. Mm-hmm. So I think people know that that's kind of where I'm coming from. And also, I mean, a lot of my audience are people who are, you know, have a critical relationship with their faith. And I, you know, I want to both encourage that and show that that's not a bad thing, but actually can be a very enriching part of your life.
And do you think for many of those people, hearing that message that it's okay to have those critical thoughts is life-giving because they've never heard that before?
Yeah, I mean, that's the core. That's where I started with my work, put it that way. And actually, I've had a few friends who have said to me, Pete, you know, that still should be your central message, because, of course, I've got other interests. I want to explore that in a deeper way. But actually, for some people who are maybe, you know, maybe late teens, early 20s, who are coming out of, you know, quite a conservative background, and they haven't heard someone say it's okay to ask questions. And in fact, it's good to ask questions and to really encourage that. That can be, you know, life transforming for individuals. I've been in conservative settings where, you know, I've given a talk and I simply said something like, you know what, I'm a heretic. And so are you. You know, we're all heretics. We all get things wrong and mess up, and that's okay. And just that really simple message, this very simple message for someone who's never heard that before, can be quite shocking in a positive way.
Yeah. How long did you go in your faith journey before you realized that was okay yourself?
I think, well, so I got into the whole kind of Christianity relatively late. At 17, I had this kind of conversion experience and got into kind of evangelical kind of church. But they were very, very beautiful people and very encouraging. They taught me how to speak. They gave me real encouragement to be able to stand up in front of people, to read, to reflect. You know, actually the opposite of what people think sometimes when they hear the word evangelical, they think, oh, you know, sign your brain at the door. But actually I went in with no qualifications. I left school at 16 years old. I had nothing. And, you know, they encouraged me to start thinking about deep issues of life and death and God and faith. And of course there was a certain kind of orthodoxy that you were supposed to affirm. But I was encouraged by some of the leaders to ask any questions I wanted. So it was kind of always a part of it. But there was a point about 5 years into that, when I was in my early 20s, when I felt that I had to kind of like go deeper with those questions than that community could probably handle. Mm-hmm. So that's where I kind of then started to move out of that community. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Well, okay, so when we were together in Malibu, you told me that you were thinking about trying to do stand-up comedy.
Oh, that's right, yes.
Are you still thinking about doing that? Have you done it?
Oh, you got to push me on this, because it's still in the back of my mind. I know a couple of friends who are comedians now, and I do want to do it, but I haven't actually got up and gone to the open mics yet.
Yeah, well, I really think you should. And as you said that, in the back of my head, I thought, that would be a good bucket list thing to do. I feel like I would like to try that. And if you did it, I could rip off some of your stuff, maybe get an accent, and then I could do it myself.
Absolutely. And you know what? I mean, the only place, there's two places I think that people go to hear someone speak for an hour. The art of storytelling, the art of communication. And of course, one of that is church. Mm-hmm. And so particularly in like the Pentecostal tradition, there is a real art to speaking. And the other is comedians.
Yeah.
Comedians are, for in the Western world, I think, are storytellers. They bring out moral points. They bring out philosophical ideas. But they do it in ways that are entertaining, ways that are funny, etc. So for me, I do encourage people to learn from comedians. And I think if anyone is a public speaker, they should try a little bit of comedy.
Yeah. Did you just go see Louis C.K. recently?
Yeah.
How was that?
Brilliant. He's brilliant. Louis C.K. is part of the existentialist tradition of comedy, which is the tradition that I really like. Mm. And, for example, he spent probably 20 minutes talking about death. this is a comedian, right? You're sitting there, 20 minutes on death. And it was like dark stuff, but it was brilliant because he said what many of us feel. He was very upfront about it. And so we were laughing. You were also reflecting on, our finitude, reflecting on some of the biggest issues that we face, but in a way that, as I say, that the place was packed. It's the same place that you two are playing in LA. Like, there was thousands of people there to engage with and listen to this guy talking about middle age, talking about raising kids, talking about facing our death, and talking about how to live. It was beautiful.
His bit that he did on Conan years ago about how everything's wonderful but no one's happy, the airplane thing, they get Wi-Fi and the guy next to him is ticked because it goes out 5 minutes after it's told to him. I've used that probably three times in sermons. It is such a good bit.
Yeah. I mean, comedians at their best say things that we all know but haven't quite put together. So whenever you hear that, because it's not a joke, in a sense. Like, he's just ranting. He's not telling a joke. He's saying something just the way it is. But it's funny because, it's funny because it's true, but it's funny because we all know it's true. We all act like that. We get frustrated at life when really it's incredible. And so that's what I like about, what Louis C.K. is doing. He's a truth teller. Mm-hmm. And it's funny.
Yeah, he's brilliant. You said a second ago that he comes from the existentialist tradition. For those who aren't familiar with that, how would you define that in his work?
For me, the existentialist philosophers, they were, Kierkegaard is one of the prime ones, Nietzsche as well, but they were philosophers who wanted to look at what it means to exist, what it means to be human, what it means to embrace and our responsibility for our lives, and to look at our death. And so anyone who's really doing that is part, I think, in that tradition.
No, yeah, that's good. Okay, so in the background you hear Pete does not actually have children, but he has graciously opened his home to one of his good friends, and now he has dogs and kids and family behind him because he is sharing his home. And that's what we get to hear in the background of this podcast. So we're excited to have them there. Okay, let's talk about the book. So you have a new book, Divine Magician. Did I get the title right?
Yeah, that's right. That's correct.
I always get those wrong. When does it actually come out? Did it come out a couple weeks ago?
Just dropped last week.
Okay, great. Now, is it a part of kind of like a trilogy? I feel like you were saying that to me. I wasn't sure if you actually have communicated as that.
Yeah, it's kind of loosely part of a trilogy. The last two books that I've written and this one together articulate a vision of Christianity and of faith that I've kind of been working on. So they don't follow like logically on from each other, but they're like three different ways of looking at the same thing.
Yeah, you can see in this book some of the topics that I think you touched on in Idolatry of God that you can continue to develop. Now, whenever you read a Pete Rollins book, there are two things you are guaranteed to get. One is great parables, which this book delivers on, and two is plenty of movie references, which, again, this book always delivers on. So well done on that.
Thank you. Yeah. I actually don't watch that many movies. It's weird that I have so many kind of references when I actually don't watch very many at all.
Are you serious? Because there's a ton of them that you use.
Yeah, I suppose I keep an ear out for movies that sound like they have a real depth of insight, and then I'll watch them. So I've got friends who are very good at, who are movie critics or who know a lot about film, and if they suggest something, then I'll watch that.
So who suggested Mission Impossible 3 from your last book?
Oh, well, that's a guilty pleasure. I love the Mission Impossible films.
Yeah, I wonder which film critic would actually get behind that one. Yeah. Okay, anyway, so this one, magic is the metaphor that you work with. Is that something that you had interest in before the book?
No, not really. I mean, I was reading a philosopher who's influenced me a lot, a guy, Zizek, and he mentioned something about the magic trick, the three-part illusion, and he connected it with Christianity. And it was kind of a passing reference he made, and that initially got my interest, and then that became the inspiration for the book.
Okay, so with a basic magic trick, there's three parts. You have the pledge, or say you show the coin that you're going to hide. The pledge is the first part. The second part is the turn, where you hide it, and then you do the sleight of hand. And the third part is the prestige, where you reveal it again. Did I get that right?
Absolutely. So if I've got a coin, and I hold it up in front of you, the audience, that's the pledge. The coin is the pledge. Then I put it behind a curtain, pull back the curtain and the coin's gone, that's the turn. And then the prestige is when I pull the coin out from behind my ear. There you go. It's a illusion.
Okay, so that's going to be the framework for the discussion about this book, and so we'll just keep it in the background. And so the first thing you talk about, or maybe not the first thing, but one of the centerpieces of what you're talking about is the sacred object. And that's the thing that is whatever we think will fill us. It's money, it's health, it's relationship. I think in The Idolatry of God, you actually talked about the MacGuffin, which in some ways, is there a tie-in to those two concepts together? And the MacGuffin?
Yeah.
And so the MacGuffin is like the thing in a movie that gets kind of the plot rolling, right? And so you have these things or the sacred objects. Now, okay, so first of all, why are we talking about this so much? Why do you see that as such a centerpiece to how we understand, you know, faith, God, theology, all that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I see this idea of the sacred object, the object that, you know, as you say, will give you wholeness, completeness, that will satisfy you, that object is first of all a fiction. This doesn't exist. And secondly, it's responsible for a huge amount of human suffering, not simply personal suffering, but also how we treat other people. So political suffering, it connects in with religion, and negative forms of religion. It connects in with deep violence and war. And so what I want to do is draw out how the sacred object that we often pursue, even when we're not conscious of it, is responsible for so much of our strife. And also to show how I think Christianity can be read as a good news, a type of freedom from that object.
Yeah. So if we're trying to think of what the sacred object is in our life, you know, obviously we talked about money or health or relationships. What are ways that we can determine the things that we give this sacred object position in our life to?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of, you have to keep an eye on your actions, really. You know, look at how you live your life. What are you living your life for? Anything can be a type of sacred object. Now, I would say the first object, the very first object that holds this space is the primary caregiver, usually the mother, you know, because that's the first experience of loss we have as a child is whenever, you know, we're taken from the mother's breast and we feel separate from that other person. Mm-hmm. And then really, I think that everything else is a type of echo of that original sense of loss.
So are you a Freud fan?
Yeah, very much so.
Okay.
I'm a fan of a number of people, but Freud's definitely one of them.
Okay, my dad's a psychologist, and I make him listen to all the podcasts, and I gave him The Idolatry of God as like a, you know, maybe a birthday gift months ago, and honestly, I think you are his favorite guest I've ever had.
Oh, wow.
And he's actually worked some of your stuff into one of his classes, and I forget which one it was, but when you talk about the mother, my first thought was, my dad would like that. He likes Freud, too.
Well, you know, it's very key because, I mean, very quickly, the creation myth of psychoanalysis, to call it this creation myth, is that we are born, that we experience a separation initially from, you know, the primary caregiver. Mm-hmm. And that's very traumatic for us, very traumatic. Now, actually, for some of us, we don't get that separation. We're too close to our primary caregiver. And we never fully differentiate and become our individual selves. And that leads to psychosis, right? Yeah, so psychosis results from that. If we're able to separate from the mother, but we're not fully able to move on in our lives, perversion is the psychoanalytic term that's used for problems that arise out of that. And if we're able to, you know, fully separate, neurosis kind of is one of the positions that you have. Now, very, very quickly, what I'm kind of arguing is in religion, there's something similar going on, that the role of religion is not to get us back to a certain idea of God as that which will fill us, make us whole, and make us complete, which is most, I think, religion. We conspire with religion to try to help us feel whole and complete and return to something we feel we've lost. But my argument is, actually, the role of the church is to help us separate from that notion of God. Otherwise, psychosis results, religious psychosis, where you feel you get delusions, you feel you're one with God, you have all of these things come out, or there's theological perversions we could talk about. But ultimately, for me, Christianity is about getting us away from that idolatrous notion of God so that we can fully live in the world. And ultimately, I would say, find God or the sacred in our full engagement with the world.
Yeah. So if I was going to tell someone what Pete Rollins 101 is, I would say that God does not exist to make you whole and happy. I feel like that's like that's your fastball. You're always going to go back to that. Actually, the last author who was on the podcast was Donald Miller. And do you know who Donald? Familiar with his work?
Him, but I haven't met him.
Okay, so at his he tells a story at the end of his book, his newest book, that at his rehearsal dinner, he gets up and gives the anti-Jerry Maguire speech. He said, I want you guys to know that my wife, Betsy, she does not complete me. She does not fulfill me. And I thought, that doesn't sound like Donald Miller. That sounds like a speech that Pete Rollins would give at his rehearsal dinner.
Yes. Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so we're not expecting people to feel that. We don't expect God to feel that. Why is it so wrong to think that God is going to do that? Because for many of us, that is how we understand religion. That's how we understand God. But that's not something that God offers, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a good question. You know, like, why would I be against the people being happy, whole, and complete? And the answer is very simply just that I think that this notion results in more problems than it solves, that actually the pursuit of wholeness and satisfaction actually generates more of an unhappiness. I'm sorry, there was something ringing in the background. I apologize.
Hey, your house just looks like mine now. This is what people, dogs, children, that's just normal for me.
Okay. I'm sorry. Let me put it like this. In L.A., if you go out on a Friday or Saturday night, you look around, everybody looks like they're having a good time. Everyone's enjoying themselves. People are like beautiful looking, they're smiling, they're dancing, it's amazing. And actually, being in that environment can actually be quite depressing. You suddenly start to feel, oh my goodness, I don't have what these other people have. But what you discover is that a lot of the other people who are in this environment are also feeling the same kind of like gap in their lives and feeling I'm not quite living up to it. So we're all conspiring in this kind of pretense that none of us really believe. And so my argument is that we all want to pursue something that will make us happy, and that's a good thing. And we go out and we party, or we try to make money, or we try to, we have kids, we think that will satisfy us completely, whatever it is. That's very natural. But there's also a need to be free from the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. So there's the freedom to pursue what will make you happy, but there's the freedom from the pursuit. And for me, Christianity is more in line with the second, that the good news is you can be free from the pursuit of wholeness and completeness, which means embracing lack, embracing suffering as part of life, embracing the darkness as well as the light. It's like there's an old Zen saying, which is, before enlightenment, I was depressed. After enlightenment, I am depressed. Going, oh, great, what does that mean, But this Zen master says this, which is basically saying, you think that enlightenment will get rid of your depression? No, it won't. You'll still be depressed. But after enlightenment, you'll be able to bear your depression. You'll be able to embrace it. You won't be destroyed by it. And in a similar way, I'm saying that God is not in the escape from suffering and the giving us what we want and what will make us whole. But God is that which helps us bear all of the emotions of life.
So often the way that we understand dealing with that longing and that ache, that hole, is the idea that those things will ultimately be fulfilled in the afterlife. Like heaven is going to be the place where that happens. Now, if I understand what you're saying is that you're pointing towards a realized eschatology, pointing towards the right now, and you're saying that that's maybe not where to go. Like, that idea of waiting for heaven to realize it is not really that healthy. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, whatever, you know, happens in the next life or whatever, and I would say that the problem with thinking like that is this life becomes like a waiting room. It becomes something we just, you know, tread water until we die, until the good times happen. But you know, what I want to say is, actually, there's something beautiful about lack and about not having what you want. And actually, in psychoanalysis, is very key that people get attached to things that they think will satisfy them completely, whether it's a person or a career. And all manner of problems happen as a result of that. And part of what you try to do in analysis is help people realize that desire is something that's good. And the idea is that the lack in you kind of opens up new possibilities and new worlds. And that's actually, instead of getting fixated on something which drains everything else of meaning, we can somehow start to enjoy a wider array of life, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, now, I'm sure you're familiar with some of Miroslav Volf's work, in which he talks about the, if you don't know his story, I mean, he grew up in a country that was obviously torn apart by civil war, and there are terrible things that are happening. And if I understand his work correctly, part of what he's pushing towards is we can choose nonviolence because we know that there is divine justice in the end. And obviously you're from Northern Ireland. You're far more familiar with that kind of strife than someone, you know, from my background is used to. But many of us are able to function in a certain way here on Earth that we think is more Christ-like because we believe in the end there will be justice. How can you function that way with your realized eschatology?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, one of the things I worry about is that hope, the way you see it in some forms of religion, is a type of like saying, okay, in the next life things will be better, which means that, you know, I don't have to do anything, right? And then sit back, someday it's all going to be good. There's a second type of hope, and it's a hope that demands that you act. And if I think about it like this, like if you have kids, you have kids, if you say, I hope they go to university, that hope demands that you do something, right? So you don't go, I hope they go to university, and then sit back and do nothing. You go, I hope they go to university, and so you start putting money aside. You start reading to them. You try to develop their interest in academia, whatever it is. So it's a hope that demands your response. It's a hope that demands you put your shoulder to the wheel of history and push. In the same way, I think Christian hope at its best is a hope that demands that you act, not a hope that gets you to sit back. So the hope that I'm interested in is, like in Northern Ireland, it's going like, I hope that the society can be better, that people can find justice here, that people who are homeless can find homes, that people who have lost loved ones can put their lives back together again and bring up their children in ways that doesn't perpetuate the violence. That's the type of hope that I think is Christian hope. That's the type of hope that I affirm. And I do worry about any type of hope that actually takes away our responsibility and our need to act in the world.
Okay. So I love that. And I'm trying to think now of someone who's in a really tough situation where, health isn't good for them, or, you know, they've lost a loved one and there's a child that they're never going to get to see again. And hope is the way that it keeps them going through their pain right now. What does that realized eschatology look for them like?
Yeah, I mean, within reason, I think for all of us, there are things that can get better. I mean, I have to be honest and go, you know, if you're very, very ill and you're on the verge of dying, then the hope that I'm talking about might not be of much value.
Okay.
Absolutely. You know, I don't want to say that I've got the full answer, but I would say for most of us, interestingly, what enriches our lives is relative to our experience of life. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you are a really fit Olympic runner, then what you want to do is you want to kind of like get faster at your running and get better at that. That's not a hope that I have at all. You know, I run 15 minutes around the block. I'm coughing up blood, right? So my hope is that I can run that 15 minutes and not cough up blood, right?
That's a great goal, yeah.
Thank you. But, and it's not that I don't feel like, oh my goodness, I'll never run like that Olympic runner. That's not in my range of either possibilities or wants. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I'm not able-bodied or something like that, you know, my hopes are going to be different and they're going to be reflected differently. But I think our lives can be enriched. And I believe that all of us can lead rich lives, even though some people, through circumstance, through contingent realities, through maybe hard work, I don't know, but through, maybe we'll have more than others. But that doesn't mean that two people can't have like rich, hope-filled lives.
Yeah, if I'm reading your stuff correctly, what I see you pointing towards is a greater understanding of the meaning of what's right in front of you right now. Is that fair?
Yeah.
And so you tie that to the Eucharist as kind of the end, the prestige, if we go back to the magic metaphor. Can you kind of elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, the interesting thing about the magic trick is it's not simply like just this metaphor plucked out of thin air. There was actually an archbishop in the 18th century who noticed that the magicians would say hocus pocus at a key point in the trick. And he was like, I think they're taking the mick out of hoc est corpus, what the priest says at Mass when the bread and the wine is transubstantiated, right? So he kind of thought, you know what, these people are kind of playing with religious themes. In fact, when a magician talks about the patter is the talk that the magician does. That probably comes from Paternoster, which is the prayers of the monks and the nuns in the monasteries. So what I want to do is, well, Tillotson, by the way, the archbishop, he thought this was a terrible thing. And he thought, yes, the Eucharist isn't a magic trick. But what I do in the book is I take the opposite tack and go, well, maybe he's right, but maybe this is a good thing. Because in the Eucharist, you have three parts, just like the illusion. You have got the pledge, which is the bread and the wine. Here's the sacred right in front of you. You can touch it. This is God, right? Then you have the turn, which is, of course, the disappearance. And that's where you consume the bread and the wine. And then you have the prestige. Now, in the magic trick, we didn't mention this, but we should, is the prestige, you don't generally get back what you lost. You think you're getting back the same coin, but you're not. Right? In the prestige of the Eucharist, you get back the sacred, but it's slightly different. You're waiting and waiting and waiting for the object to return, and then you realize, we are the body and blood of Christ. This is the sacred. The sacred is no longer an object that we can touch, that we can taste, that we can smell. The sacred is a depth dimension to all of life. The sacred is manifested when we love one another, when we care for one another. And for me, the church, in its role, is ultimately to enact this three-part magic trick. People come to church because they are broken, sometimes because they're hurt, because something's not working, because they think God will make it better. Then there's the turn where they start to realize, oh my goodness, God doesn't work like that. It doesn't happen like that, you know? And that's traumatic. But then there's the prestige where the person realizes, but hold on a second, God is in the midst of the suffering and the brokenness. And as I'm able to bring that stuff to the light of day, as I'm able to share it with the people around me, I'm able to rob that of its sting and be able to live in a better, more full, and more rich way.
Yeah. So the person of faith in your world is not so much known by the philosophical outlook that he or she affirms, but it's more about the way that they embrace and their commitment to life.
Yes.
So kind of explain a little bit more, because that's weird to us, because most of us assume that being a Christian is about a certain set of beliefs that you hold to, not so much a way of life.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I'm trying to overturn. For me, Christianity is an expression of a way of life. It's a way of being free from that idolatrous sacred object and being able to find meaning and depth in all of our life and letting that come out in our political and religious and cultural expressions. Instead of conspiring with religion to escape our suffering, we find rituals and ways of life that help us, be able to accept it and change it in real ways. So for me, I read the Bible not as a set of beliefs, but as expressing a dynamic. Now, there are beliefs in the Bible, of course. There's lots of beliefs, I mean, and different ones. You know, there's monotheism, there's polytheism, there's henotheism, where there's lots of gods, but one rules over them all. You know, there's different beliefs in the text. What I'm interested in is actually expressing and exploring the dynamic. What is the drive of the text? Amidst all of the different beliefs, amidst all of the different ideas, is there a way of life, a way of being in the world that is expressed in that text? And what does that look like? And that's what I'm interested in. For me, that's what Christianity is. You know, you could believe all the right things, in inverted commas, like all the things that I agree with. You could believe them all and still be a broken, bitter, isolated, lonely individual, shame-filled individual. And you could believe all of the right things, you know, all of the things that people have affirmed through the centuries. But, or you could believe stuff that I don't believe. You could be very different from me. Believe all these things that I think are bizarre. But potentially you could be living a life that is inspiring, that is rich, that is free. And for me, that's what's of interest. It's not about the what of belief, what you believe. It's the how of belief. How does your belief function? How does it reflect a life lived?
Do you think it's easier to ascribe to a quote-unquote right set of beliefs than it is to live a right way of life? Do you think it's easier to have that like as a bullseye and say, okay, I can have my understanding of the Bible and, you know, theodicy and all these things pinpointed correctly, and I can see that, whereas if I look at my life, it seems like it's a lot more challenging to say that, yes, I'm living a right life, because we know our relationships are flawed. We know that our goals are sometimes very jaded. You know, it seems like it would be easier just to worry about beliefs and actions.
Yeah, I think beliefs are easy. It's actually, I used to, you know, help people believe. I used to be an evangelist in my youth, and it was easy to get people to believe. It's actually much harder to get people to ask questions and to look at the difficult things in life. I mean, it's very hard for us to be honest about the things that are within our minds and the things that we are haunted by. We are all haunted by many things, and we want to push that stuff down. But I love that verse in the Bible that says, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." Because I've often thought, what does that mean? You know, it obviously doesn't mean truth as in you'll know that squares have four sides, and that will set you free. You know, you'll know how a black hole works, and that will set you free, right? So what could it mean? Well, the way I read it is that the truth, our truth, are the things that the anxieties we have, the fears we have, the hatred we have, the anger we have, the love we have, all of this stuff. And there's a cacophony of things in us that we hide. But if we were able to bring that stuff to the surface, we will be able to rob it of its power, and we will find freedom. And that's what Christianity is for me, is that you shall know the truth. The truth shall come up if you're courageous enough to do that work. And that will transform everything about your life and how you interact with other people.
How do we know that truth is coming up? I mean, what are ways that we can realize the way that the Spirit has worked in us to set us free? Or is there an example you can point to of how that's happened?
Yeah, I mean, you can take, you know, lots of different examples, but, you know, you take a family, if you're married, and have been married for many years, and, you know, maybe on the surface they're all saying everything's great, we still love each other, everything's fantastic, they're putting up lots of pictures of themselves on Facebook and nice status updates and all of that. But, you know, maybe things aren't quite as good as they appear. There's like emotional affairs or maybe affairs going on. There's bitterness and anger. But as long as it's not spoken about, everything can continue as normal. Now, the thing is, everybody kind of knows something's going on, but nobody ever talks about it. Now, for me, when that happens, symptoms arise. And that means like what you cannot speak will find ways of speaking. So maybe it comes out in the kids fighting in school. Maybe it comes out in one person being on the computer too much, the other person overworking, whatever it is. In that environment, this is simply saying that that couple need to be able to speak the stuff that's there, that they're not talking about, that everybody knows is there, that's expressed in the symptom. Bring that to the surface. And then one of two things will happen. Either they'll break up because they'll go like, okay, you know, it's not working. Or they'll find a new way of relating to each other and they'll kind of work through it. But one thing is they won't be able to continue as they've been continuing for so long. And the reason why they don't bring stuff up is because they think, if we bring this stuff up, there'll be a crisis. But the truth is the relationship already is in crisis. They're just not looking at it. So that's a very concrete example of what it means to bring the truth to the surface, mm-hmm. to know your truth, is to bring that up, and it will change the relationship.
So what do you think it would look like for a church that decided we're not going to focus just on beliefs, but on actions and life? What would it the function of that sort of community be for each other?
Yeah, I mean, so like an analogy I often use is like an Irish pub. People use an Irish pub for one of two reasons. You either go to a bar and you get drunk and try to forget about your suffering, and you have a laugh and you listen to some terrible music and there's lots of TVs on the wall. No, that's not an Irish pub, actually. That's like a sports bar. But sports bar's a good example, actually. Sports bar, you go and you forget about your suffering. You look at some football, you listen to music, you dance or whatever. But then the suffering comes back. So the next day, you feel really bad again. And so you kind of have to repeat the same act. And people start going to the bar every week just to escape their brokenness. But if you go to an Irish pub, you can also find people who go there to have a drink and to talk about their life, to express how they're doing. And you'll have some singer-songwriter in the corner, some Irish singer who's talking about their lost loves. Typical Irish, you know, we're all talking about our lost loves. You know? But they'll sing about that. And what happens is you listen to that and it connects you with your own suffering and brokenness. And talking about your life with your friends helps you work it through. For me, the church can often be like a sports bar. You go, you sing the songs, you forget about your suffering. But it comes back, and so you become addicted to the church and you start going 3 days a week. But the church should be more like an Irish pub, where you go and the music, the rituals, the prayers, the sermon help you touch upon and bring to light the things that you struggle with. Not so that you despair, but actually so that you can find release from that burden. For example, like, within the conservative church, belief often functions as a way of protecting people from anxiety. So you'll notice that you have to believe the right thing, right? And if you question it, you can get kicked out. Now, the liberals, it's different. You can question anything in the liberal tradition. Oh, God doesn't exist. You know, the devil's great. You know, Jesus was just a guy, right? And they'll be like, fine. But then you say, well, you know what? I think we should move the altar 5 foot to the right. And everyone kicks up a fuss, you know, over my dead body, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what's preventing them from looking at their anxiety. So for me, the role of the church is to go, right, what is it? Is it belief? Is it practices? What is it that's protecting us from looking at the things we'd rather not look at? And how do we help that happen in a way that brings life to the people in the congregation?
Yeah. So I want to try to talk about that addicted to church thing. I thought that was really interesting. We want to be able to be aware of what's really going on and people suffering. But I think there's something about the addiction that people go to church, especially like a church that's like a fear-mongering, God hates you kind of church, where God's mad at you and you're told that you're not trying hard enough. And there is something that happens, like you feel something there. And I think in a lot of ways, many of us are just numb to life and we're too busy and we're too medicated by media and TV and all that stuff so that we don't ever like sit with our feelings and experience life. And sometimes you go to church and you feel guilty about something, and that becomes like your only connection to any real feeling. And so you want to keep going back because it gives you this buzz, even if the buzz isn't really a genuine like God experience, but we start to wire it that way. What did you mean by like addicted? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. For me, often the church can compete with every other voice that we have in the world. So everyone in the world's kind of offering us, you pursue this vision and you'll be happy, you buy this product, you'll be happy. Magazines, TV programs, you know, nightclubs, everyone's kind of promoting it, an idea that you can be whole and complete. It's like self-help. It's everywhere. Take this certain drug. So in LA, ayahuasca is very big. It's like the God drug, you know, New Age practices. There's a lot of new technology. There's so many things that are offering transcendence, offering escape from our lives. And the church then, you know, has offered just in one more way of trying to do that. But for me, that's what I mean when I say that there's the freedom to pursue what will make you happy or what you think will make you happy, but there's also the freedom from that pursuit. Yeah. And that's what I want to see on a Sunday morning or whatever, is you go and you're able to stop all of that. Because guilt is often connected with not being able to get what you think you want, etc.
Yeah.
But you're able to be. I mean, my analogy is AA. AA for me is probably the most innovative form of church life in the 20th century. And it's not a church, but it kind of is. I mean, for me, it is what a denomination should be. It's a group of people getting together and saying, like, I have a problem. In a community of grace that accepts the person for what they're saying and doesn't ask them to change, just says, that's okay, I'm like that too. And then in that place of grace where you can just admit to your problems, admit to life being difficult with people who are also struggling, you find freedom. And then once you've done that, you have like these 12 steps, you have like little kind of like help on how to maybe improve your life. But that comes after. It's like, you know what? We're here to just breathe a sigh of relief, be honest about our struggles and the bad stuff in us. By the way, we're riven with bad things. I mean, this is my problem with prayer, is if people pray and go, you know, I pray for the kids in Sudan, I pray for what's happening in Iraq, we pretend we care, but we don't care. Most of us don't care. You know, we'd like to pretend we care. We like to have that image we care, but I don't. I haven't done anything. I haven't flown out there. I haven't given money, you know. Actually, the first thing I have to do is I have to go, I'm Peter Rollins, and I don't care about what's going on in other parts of the world. And then I have to sit with that, with a community of people going, that's okay, we don't really either. And then you go, and you know what, that's probably not great. Maybe I should try and do something about that. And then hopefully you become a more caring and active person in the world. That's what I'm arguing for with church.
Oh, that's good. I think it's a beautiful picture of what church can be. I love your line that the true distinction is between those who hide their lack under the fiction of wholeness and those who are able to embrace it. And I feel like that's like what you just described is a really great picture of what an authentic community can be when they just admit who they are, how they lack, and be at peace with it.
Yeah, so absolutely. And this is like, that's the thing. This is like the opposite of self-help. This is not like we sit around and it's all, you know, we kind of try to find a way to be happy, whole, and complete. For me, basically, when Jesus said, the poor you will always have with you, that's incredibly insightful. I mean, you can hear it and go, that's really depressing. The poor you'll always have with you. That's awful. Why should we bother trying to do anything? But what if we are all poor in different ways? And we've got two options. One is we avoid looking at our poverty, and so we get someone else to carry it. We put it on someone else. We blame someone else for the problems. Or we learn to carry our own poverty. And in that, we become more whole and beautiful and caring individuals. And that is the thing for the church for me, is that we realize our poverty. And strangely, in realizing our poverty, we find a richness and a wealth.
That's good news right there, Pete.
That's good news, man. You know, it's like it's weird to say the good news is finding freedom from the pursuit of happiness. But that, I think, is really good news.
No, that's beautiful. I think that's you should write that down, put it in a book so people can read it. That's a really good idea. Okay, so obviously the book is The Divine Magician. It is out. It's on Amazon. It's anywhere you need to really get a book. It's there. It's available. You need to do that. What else is on the docket for Pete Rollins? I know you've got just announced a new study thing with your new roommate, Trip Fuller.
Yeah, Trip Fuller, absolutely.
He's of Homebrewed. What is the name of his podcast? Homebrewed something.
Homebrew Christianity.
Yeah, very popular podcast. So what are you guys working on?
Yeah, so, I mean, Homebrew's great. For anybody who's interested in theological ideas, it provides real food for the mind. And they've been doing that for a lot of years. But I actually now teach with Trip a little bit, and we do in-depth studies on philosophy and theology. So this time we're going to look at Paul, because there's been this return to Paul in theology and philosophy. There's a pile of philosophers who have no interest in Christianity or the church that have been writing books on the Apostle Paul, because they find in him this political revolutionary figure. So we're going to take a few weeks and we're going to look at this figure and look at why these writers are returning to Paul.
How can people learn more about that if they want to check it out?
Oh, yeah, just go onto my website, peterrollins.net, and you'll find, under speaking, you'll find details.
What's the latest on your the thing you're going to do in Northern Ireland? I think it was called Trick of Lights, is that right?
Oh, yeah, Tricks of the Light.
Tricks,
yeah.
Okay.
I'm so excited. It's the highlight of my year. Every year I bring 40 people from all over the world to my favorite city in the world, Belfast, and we put on a four-day mini festival with music, poetry, art. We go out and drink at night. We do music. It's a festival of ideas, a festival of thought, a festival of music and fun. And I've been doing it for 3 years. This year we sold out, which is fantastic. So we've got a lot of people coming back. It's a real opportunity for me to take 4 days and go deeply into the ideas that we're discussing. So if anybody wants to know about that, I'll be running it again next year. This year, sadly, is all sold out, but next year we'll go on sale soon. Mm-hmm.
You know, what city is it going to be in?
Belfast.
You say that's your favorite city. I guess you've never been to Dallas.
Because
I feel like Texas would be probably the best place for anything to happen. And so maybe you need to kind of rethink your priorities, make a trip to Texas, because everyone knows everything's bigger and better in Texas.
Everything's bigger and better. And you know what? Houston is a city I love. Houston. Because they've got my favorite chapel in the world, the Rothko Chapel, right in the heart of Houston.
Hold on.
I love that place.
Even Texans don't like Houston, okay? So we don't – that doesn't count. Hey, Pete, thanks for your time, man. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.